Hi, I'm John Rawling, welcoming you to Ringside Rewind, where I'm joined by Tris Dixon and Ian Dark. And we're grateful for sponsorship from Fleet UK, a car and commercial vehicle leasing company based in Hampshire, supporting our programme. Great people who've supplied customers for 20 years or more, including me. Wherever you are, they'll find and supply any car you want and work out financing options to best suit your needs. Fleet UK pride themselves on transparency, trust and fairness in every deal. And you can take it from me, they are brilliant at what they do. Just have a look and check them out at fleetuk.com.
Hello, welcome back to Ringside Rewind with me, Tris Dixon, Ian Dark and John Rawling. We might have John's dog barking in the background. I can't guarantee that just yet today. But gents, it's nice to see you as always. And this week, we're going to talk about press conferences. And I mean, I think it's a tough one, isn't it? That there's obviously different press conferences. There's the fight announcement. There's the pre-fight press conference on fight week. And then there's the post-fight press conferences. I suppose because it's fresh in our minds, this week, Tyson Fury and Alexander Usyk announced their fight for February the 17th. So they've given themselves, a three-month runway now to that fight. Ian, I mean, is that the typical press conference that you remember from days gone by?
Yeah, just about. Nothing much changes, I think. So we've got Tyson Fury calling Usyk a sausage and then singing Run, Rabbit, Run to him and how he's going to get smashed to bits and so on and so forth. And Usyk handled it absolutely perfectly by just saying, you know what, I'll do my talking in the ring. So, hey, look, these press conferences are there, aren't they, to publicize fights, the pre-fight press conferences. All manner of, near riots can go on at them, punches being thrown, verbal crossfire, phony ballyhoo. You come back almost to the germ, I think, of the argument we'll get to here is sports editors have to ask themselves the question, well, I kind of like that because it's good copy for my paper. And I can also get my columnists to write a piece saying, you know, who needs this gutter stuff from boxing again? So it's a complicated issue.
Yeah, John, I think Ian's touched on some really good points there in the sense that if both people had, if Fury and Usyk had both played a straight bat, yes, they would have got column inches, but it'd be very little to talk about from last night. So I'm not saying Fury and his rabbit and goodness me, what a sausage insults and all the rest of it was the right thing to do. But without that, there's not much point behind them, I guess, right? Because if you've got two guys that aren't your Naz, your Eubanks or whatever, it's tough going, isn't it, potentially sometimes?
Well, and of course, Alexander Usyk doesn't have good command of English, so it's difficult to get anything out of him, even allowing for the fact that he's playing a straight back bat. I mean, I think what Frank Warren, Eddie Hearn and others have learnt really is the Don King lesson. Whether or not it's a good thing is another question. But I think Don was very much of the P.T. Barnum persuasion. Don't worry exactly what you say about it. I don't care what you say about it, as long as you say something. Get my name in the paper. Get my fight in the paper. Now get it on social media. Get the press conference repeated, edited, and played out ad nauseum. And that, over the last 24 hours or so, is what we've seen.
It's almost become hasn't it, though, that this press conference, you know, this lark that we've seen at the Fury one, it is just a bit old hat, yet nobody's really thought of a better way of publicising fights in the modern era when boxing has to fight harder than it ever has done for some space in the newspapers.
Yeah, and I suppose there's this, John. Sorry, John, go on.
Well, I was just going to say, I'll just throw this little grenade in and take it for what it's worth and maybe react accordingly. I was having a look round on Facebook and X before I started this and trying to get some reaction to yesterday's press conference. And I saw something from John H. Stracey, who I'm pretty sure is now our senior surviving former world champion, became world champion with one of the great performances away from the British shore back in the 1970s, became the world welterweight champion. And he came out with this. He said, could he really sink any lower? Usyk showed nothing but respect as the great world champion he is and an ambassador for the sport. Fury, on the other hand, showed nothing but disrespect, animosity, and despicable behavior from a man who should be setting an example and representing our country. For those who think his attitude helps build up fights, I disagree.
Mm. Well, it's a good hand grenade, John, and you're right, and people will write that, and they will write it justifiably as well about Tyson Fury. I mean, there's an element always, isn't there, with this almost of role play. And I think, you know, having spoken to Tyson, I did a big half-hour interview with Tyson when he was pretty insightful about his own image. And he said, I know I'm a pariah. I know I'm the gum on people's shoes. And I think certainly in the later stages of his career, he just played up to that baddest man on the planet image. I just wonder whether Fury's doing the same here, because that's what he does. But it's a bit rich, isn't it? Him saying, run, rabbit, run. I mean, he was the one who kept on avoiding the fight, as far as I could see, until it became pretty obvious that it had to happen, or the deal became so much in his favour for it to happen. Or am I just being a bit superficial there?
Were you at the press conference, Triz? Did you actually go down to see it?
No, I went to the one the day before to announce the Saudi Arabian bonanza on December 23rd. I got my fill that night and didn't go back the next night. I did watch it. I covered it off the live stream, so I did watch it all in its entirety. It's interesting there with what you've both touched upon, really. I just think the market now is heavily in favor of the bad guy and the anti-hero. And they're the ones who are getting the column inches. Look at the money that Floyd Mayweather's made in his career. People talk about him being a billion-dollar athlete. Not because he was going around kissing babies and shaking hands with political dignitaries and doing... And to be fair to Floyd, he has done a lot of work for different charities, but that's not what got him the column inches. Being the bad guy is what's done that. And you know, going back further still, you know, obviously Sonny Liston said about, you know, all good movies need a good guy and a bad guy. And I think that's the same with boxing. You know, I was thinking about this recently as well, actually. So, you know, Froch's fights with Mikael Kessler were far better than his fights with George Groves. But people remember the Groves fight because of the grudge, or the Groves fights because of the grudge. Same thing with James DeGale. James DeGale had an absolute barnstormer with Badu Jack, where he got half his face knocked in and bravely battled back to the scorecards. But people only talk about his fight with Groves about 15 fights before that because of the grudge and the animosity. So there's so much to be said for the good guy, bad guy. And don't get me wrong, I'm not trying to justify it. I'm just seeing it with a commercial eye, I suppose.
Yeah. Well, it is commercial, isn't it? That's what it is. I mean, I think it's up to us as media men and journalists to see through that and not buy it every time. And try to get to the nub of something more significant by way of previewing the fight. Wouldn't you agree, John?
I think it sells fight fans a little bit short. You know, the idea that there has to be a good guy and a bad guy, and that people have to be effing and blinding and saying, "I'm going to do your mother," and I'm going to smash you to pieces, your sausage. Yeah, I don't really think that's essential. I was involved heavily in a media tour prior to the fight a year or two back between Josh Warrington and Carl Frampton. And I can honestly say that going to the various places we went to publicise it, I don't think there was one word of animosity between the two of them, not a single one. And yet come the night of the fight, it was a complete sellout. There was pretty sizable advanced publicity, though clearly nothing on the scale of a world heavyweight title, but it was still healthy publicity in the build-up, and the fight itself turned out to be a bit of a barn burner. You know, it was a brilliant fight, And arguably, neither man was the same thereafter. But, you know, I don't really buy that you have to be effing and blinding and threatening to murder somebody or throwing tables around or whatever to actually sell a fight. I don't believe it's necessary.
I suppose the thing is, we've seen so much now, you know, through these press conferences, whether you're going back to the Ali days, all the way through to the present day. Like really what you said at the top, Ian, what can you do that's new? What is the way forward to, I'm not saying let's get rid of it, but I suppose these fighters are always trying to think of new ways to do things. But unfortunately, that leads to them sinking to a lot of new depths because they're in their hunger to try and do something different, something that's not been done before, I guess.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, to be honest with you, I've often laughed and had a good laugh at press conferences. And, you know, I quite enjoyed going to them, really. We used to do all kinds of things to bide away the time. Like, I mean, John will know this, the Don King press conferences, where you could be there for the best part of 2 hours before the main protagonist got to talk. You'd hear from the chief executive of, you know, whatever hotel casino was staging it, from the MGM and the, you know, vice president of HBO, and then, you know, somebody else, and then the undercard fighters and goodness knows what else. There have been plenty of laughs along the way. Do you remember the Mike Tyson Bruce Seldon press conference, where Seldon's obviously been briefed that he's got to kind of be belligerent and you know, say some pretty hard hitting things, and he gets up and says, you know, I'm going to shock the world at the weekend. Everybody knows I'm going to shock the world. You ain't seen the real Bruce Seldon yet. And somebody shouts out, "You ain't going to do shit." Seldon looks back and says, "Well, don't be like that. They told me to say this stuff."
Hey, I tell you what. I've been shown a message in the past from a former world champ who showed me this message, and I couldn't possibly reveal who it is, sadly. And he said, "Look, if we go for it at the press conference, let's split the fine from the border control because it'll be worth it in pay-per-views." Yeah. And, you know, that sort of stuff, it does happen. You know, people call it beef, or obviously fake beef. It is out there. Sometimes it happens. Sometimes there's a grudge, but sometimes the guys understand the business, and, you know, there's a right way to do it. And I suppose there's a wrong way to do it. Touching upon what John said, you know, you had two very classy guys in Arturo Gatti and Mickey Ward, and they didn't need to sell a fight between themselves. 30 violent rounds, nice guys, best friends, and yeah, everyone wanted to see it.
Yeah, but some fights sell themselves, particularly if there's, you know, it's a part of a trilogy and you've already seen these two go at it in the ring and it's an absolute barn burner. Doesn't need an awful lot of selling second time around without the verbal. So I think that's a slightly different scenario. I mean, going back to that's cynical, that arrangement you just said. I hadn't realized it went quite that far. We'll share the fine from whatever the governing body is. But I mean, there was another one with, I read about this one, one of Ali's opponents, Jean-Pierre Koopmans, was it? You'll know, Tris, I think that's right, where they were briefing him again in the car on the way to from the airport about everything he had to say, you know, about, you know, he's going to shock Ali. He respected him, but he had the tools to beat him and all this stuff. And he rushes in at the press conference and sees Ali and goes, "Muhammad, you're my hero."
Blew the lot.
Blew it in one.
That's hilarious. That's great. What a story. Hey, but I suppose there is this, right? I mean, we're talking about it with a media eye, and that's understandable. And I think that's probably what people be tuning in for, to hear some of the experiences and stories that we've seen and heard. But there is an element here of actual psychological warfare, where they do have the opportunity to get one up on an opponent. And I was convinced, and still am convinced, that Tyson Fury is lodged in the feelings and brain of Vladimir Klitschko. And he couldn't figure him out, didn't figure him out, and he remains an enigma to Klitschko, who just doesn't want anything to do with him at all moving forward. There are, and you mentioned Tyson as well. I mean, Tyson won plenty of his fights at a press conference as soon as an opponent laid eyes on him. So there is the opportunity for the games to be played in a way that could be advantageous on fight night.
Well, Fury absolutely tried to do it in the face-off, didn't he, after the press conference, when he's in Usyk's face and he gets his head on Usyk's forehead and tries to push down and tries to physically show that he's bigger and stronger and that he can push him around. And Usyk was having absolutely none of it. You know, if you're an Usyk fan, if you think Usyk can win that fight, I think that little exchange probably added to that belief.
Mind you, Sylvester Stallone didn't want any of it. Did you see that? He scarpered pretty quickly when they started to get into it. By the way, Stallone, his brother Frank is a buddy of mine. Frank wrote the foreword to my book Warrior, which you can actually buy now with Christmas coming up. You can actually buy it now.
Wow. Great film. Buy it now.
But yes, Ian, sorry, we were talking there before that shameless plug about psychological warfare. And I suppose Eubank was a good one. Naz was a good one at different ways. You know, they just by being themselves sometimes or directly going for the jugular of someone else.
Well, there's a film festival going on, an Irish film festival. I was reading about this, a movie about the fight in Mill Street between Chris Eubank and Steve Collins. It's called One Night in Mill Street, which I do want to catch if I can. I think it's on at Leicester Square in London or somewhere like that. And it's about, John will know this because he was personally involved, you know, Steve Collins' attempt to convince Eubank that he'd been hypnotized in the build-up to the fight and would feel no pain. Some would say that was an underhand tactic, bearing in mind that Eubank had already been involved in the Michael Watson near tragedy. So he was probably at a stage where he had the problem of possibly causing opponents a lot of damage in his head. So did he want to be in the ring with a guy who wouldn't feel the pain? But Eubank clearly bought that. And you remember, John, I mean, we were there having a beer. You'd done the interview, I think, with Collins where he came out with this stuff. And the fight was off briefly. It was never going.
I played it to Eubank, if you remember, Ian.
Yeah.
I got this, you know, with Collins saying, "I will feel no pain. If I bleed, I will not notice it. It is, you know, I cannot be hurt, etc., etc." And Eubank heard this one and completely flipped. And he went to he summoned Barry Hearn, who was the promoter, and said. I'm not prepared to go ahead with the fight. I'm not fighting. And certainly for a few hours until Barry somehow managed to persuade him that, you know, it's just words and it's not genuine. But that for a few hours, that fight was off. So you could say that press conference, he absolutely 100% got under the skin of Chris Eubank and freaked him out to such an extent that Eubank wasn't prepared to take the fight.
Hey, by the way, do you guys remember when Julius Francis sold the space on the soles of his boots against Mike Tyson? When did that come out? Was that in the day's paper or had that come out in a press conference beforehand? Do you remember?
It was Daily, wasn't it, involved in it? Yeah, the space on the soles of his boots, which predictably did get some airtime.
I think though, yeah, I think he was down 3 or 4 times, wasn't he? I think.
Yeah,
but yes, I mean that's not the sort of fighting talk that we're used to, where someone's actually selling real estate on their shoes.
You mentioned Tyson there and about how he intimidated opponents ahead of the fight, but he often had very, very little to say, as I remember it, at the press conferences. He just basically disengaged himself. He sat there usually looking bored. I remember the one before the first fight with Frank Bruno in Las Vegas, and Frank had got his little script worked out, and he said, you know, I know people think he's Superman, but I got kryptonite to beat him, and all this. So they said, you know, after all this had gone on, all this kind of chat about what Bruno was and what might happen, and Tyson just sat there looking bored, and they eventually, somebody said to him, well, what do you think about all that then, Mike? And he said, oh, I don't know, we'll see Saturday.
Yeah, so I mean, but I suppose that was part of Tyson's thing, wasn't it? You know, like devil may care, but also let's not forget the press conference to announce Tyson's fight with Lennox Lewis and how he went off, you know, 10, 15 minutes in that tirade.
Was that stage managed? Because they were put at opposite ends, weren't they, to keep them apart at that? And Tyson went over and actually kind of caused the mayhem, didn't he?
I mean, the bit when he bit a chunk of Lennox's thigh off that wasn't stage managed, was it?
Probably not. No. No, that never could. I can tell, but I think that probably was the real thing. I mean, I was just thinking of Lennox. Lennox was never involved in anything like that. He was always dignified and classy at press conferences and turned out perfectly dressed, you know, in a suit. And yeah, he never dissed opponents. He just did his talking in the ring, as they say.
Well, him and Rackman had that set to in the ESPN studio, didn't they? Do you remember once? And they ended up fighting over tables. And in fact, Rackman told me on a Boxing Life Stories that gave him the false sense of security that having knocked Lennox out in South Africa and then put him through a table on ESPN, it really made him think that he was the stronger man going into the rematch. And then it was lights out.
Yeah, wrong.
Exactly that. But I mean, I suppose you talk about Lennox there, that made me think of Riddick Bowe. Do you remember when he nailed Larry Donald with two shots at the weigh-in? I think a left hook and a right hand.
Yeah. Well, the punches at the weigh-in.
Barrera Morales did, right?
Yes.
He threw a glass as well. Do you remember that? I think it was at a Jorge Luis Gonzalez fight, and he lobbed a glass in the press conference, which was kind of unbelievable. And Lennox had managed to get himself around at that time, and he was sort of saying, what he was going to do, and why won't you fight me? Why won't you fight that? Why won't you fight me? Why I can do this, I can do that. And Riddick Bowe turned on Lennox and said, "Hey, you pussy, who's a faggot? You're a faggot," and coming out with all this sort of stuff. And it was fairly full on, and there was some definitely no love lost. But Ian's right. Lennox didn't sort of rise to the bait very often, and didn't say too much, which was instantly quotable. And I think the American media particularly didn't like him for that, did they? They thought he was boring. He was tedious, and that it went along with his analytical way of approaching fights, the chess player working out the tactics like he did against David Tua, for example, and just knowing exactly what he needed to do to win the fight and going out there and doing it.
Is there a press conference either of you recall that you enjoyed or thought was, particularly memorable, with these guys up at the day and something that they said or something that happened? Is there one that really stands out? I think while I allow you to think about that. Oh, sorry, Darkie. Yes, go on, mate.
Well, our favourite one, me and John, I mean, we've told the story before, but it's worth the retelling, is the famous Monster Mash in Detroit. Hamed, I think, was that against Cesar Soto? Memory is starting to serve me, not serve me so well. But where John and I are sitting in the back, and Cedric Kushner's doing the introductions. And Cedric Kushner's voice, bless him, bless his memory, sounded a little like this. He used to introduce things in this kind of manner. So he starts talking and says, "Well, I'm here as a sort of caretaker promoter of this fight involving Prince Nassim Hamed," at which point John and I are sitting in the back, and John starts doing the impersonation of the famous old record about how did he get the Monster Mash, and with the line, "I was sitting in my office late one night when I decided to promote a Hamed fight." So John and I are just laughing in the background of the press conference, and Barry Hearn, who's also up there, stops the press conference and says, "You want to share the joke? What are you two laughing at?"
We managed to sell it as well to one of the Sunday newspaper reporters who was over there, Trace. We got him to actually believe that the voice in Bobby Puckett and the Crypt Kicker 5, or whatever he was called, who did the Monster Mash, that it actually was Cedric Kushner. And at some stage in his career, before he got into boxing, he'd actually done, "It was the mash. It was the Monster Mash."
Oh, yeah. Oh, to be fair. But I mean, and we sound like a couple of amateurs, don't we, behaving like that at the press conference. But I've got to be honest about it. Sometimes, you know, that ritual was quite boring, going to the press conference, knowing there was just going to be a bit of verbal crossfire, and it wasn't going to be really relevant to what happened in the fight. Not very often. Sometimes it would be. I remember quite often I used to sit next to Jim Watt, and Jim wouldn't say much at the press conference. He'd eat the salad or salmon, whatever they provided, and a few strawberries, and sit alongside, and he'd sometimes just look and say, "Did you notice something there?" He never said he was going to win. You know, he'd pick up little things that maybe just a fighter would notice about the demeanor of a guy alongside a champion, or, you know, challenger alongside the champion. You know, he said, he didn't sound like a guy who really thinks he's going to win, does he?
When was the last time you spoke to Jim, by the way?
A month or so ago on the phone.
Is he doing okay?
Yeah, he sounds good. He's playing golf every day. I mean, you know, Jim loves golf. He'd play it morning, noon and night. So I think he often goes up to Glen Eagles and hits a ball around pretty well. So I don't think I could give him a meaningful match unless he gave me quite a few shots.
Are you on Facebook, Triz? Because if you follow Jim or Mags, his wife, he's actually quite a talented musician as well. And now and again, you'll see him sitting there strumming away on his guitar, doing various songs, and he's a passable musician. You know, I wouldn't talk about it if it was embarrassing, but he's actually pretty good.
He is, and he does magic tricks as well, doesn't he? Yep. There's pretending to throw lights across the room and all that sort of thing, which occasionally bemused a few waitresses in Las Vegas.
I think it's so the press conference thing, I think, is interesting. I will say one that stands out for all the wrong reasons was, and it's kind of typical as to where some people have seen the sport go down the wrong path, is I was in Las Vegas a few years ago now, and Paulie Malignaggi and Adrian Broner were trying to sell a fight out there, and it was horrendous to the point where I think Broner got a girl that Malignaggi was seeing on FaceTime to say that she'd been sleeping with Broner. And it was really crass, and it was beyond X-rated. And they both did themselves a huge disservice and the sport a disservice. It was probably the most tasteless one I've seen. Certainly something that you guys would not be envious for me having attended. It probably is on YouTube if anyone wants to see what I think. Probably the most cringe-worthy press conference I've been to.
Yeah, that sounds sick and horrible. You gotta know where the line is, haven't you? Even if you're trying to promote a fight.
Well, I suppose this is the thing, isn't it, Ian? It's what we're sort of talking about is, you know, each generation seems to have a line that pushes it that bit further, and it's borderline acceptable. Obviously, that's completely crossing it, but I don't know. I mean, where's the line? And it is ever moving, isn't it? I mean, the stuff that Ali was doing back then is tame by today's standards, right?
Well, yeah, he just went around calling Sonny Liston the big ugly bear, and most of the time. I mean, the stuff with Frazier now, I think in the current era, does look a bit more questionable, doesn't it? But it was kind of its time.
It was the only time, wasn't it, that you saw Frank Bruno bite? Was in the run-up to his fight against Lennox back in, what was it, 1993 in Cardiff, when he'd said that he'd been quoted suggesting that Frank Bruno was an Uncle Tom. In other words, he danced to the white man's tune to make himself famous and to make him money. And Frank resented that hugely. Lennox kind of backtracked from it and virtually denied having said it in as many words. But Frank really bore a grudge going into that fight. And, you know, I think it was no coincidence that although he lost the fight ultimately, that Bruno, for those first six rounds, he'd probably boxed as well as against anybody in any fight in his entire career.
Yeah, he was brilliant then. And do you remember the interview that he did with me after he beat McCall and finally became a world heavyweight champion? And that was almost the first thing he said. tell them all I'm not an Uncle Tom. Tell them I'm not an Uncle Tom. And I never have been. He was almost in tears. I mean, another press conference that springs to mind that I attended in my early years covering the sport was when Alan Minter was alleged to have said he was not going to lose his title to a black man ahead of fighting Marvin Hagler. And Hagler, I remember, turned up at a press conference on his own, straight from the airport, wearing a beautiful pinstripe suit, new shirt, smart, and a tie. And without any questions from the journalists, he said, "Before you all start, there's something I want to say here. I've heard about what Alan Minter is supposed to have said. He said, this fight isn't about race. He said, it's about boxing ability. It's not about skin color. And what you'll see at the weekend is that I will be the superior fighter in the ring. And basically, gentlemen, that's really all I've got to say to you at this point." And Hagler was someone who didn't usually do stuff ahead of fights. He was so classy and brilliant. And I think everybody just sort of, all us journalists looked at each other when he'd gone and just said, wow. And I kind of thought then, I think Alan Minter's in trouble here with this guy.
Yeah. He was one very, very hard man, wasn't he? And he wasn't going to let words disrupt him, I don't think. He was a remarkable fighter, Marvin.
He was a man on a mission, but guess what? With the bookmakers, he wasn't favourite to win that fight.
Fancy really?
Now, no, he was not favourite to win that fight. It was kind of seen as a 50-50 thing. And I think for the British market, I think Alan Minter was a shade of odds on at that time. So just goes to show, just as Gary Mason, bless him as well, poor old Gary, that's sad, you know, that he died so young. But now Gary Mason was favoured to beat Lennox Lewis for the British and European titles in Lennox's, I think, 15th fight. You know, strange, well, isn't it?
I'd hold my hands up on that one, Ian, because I remember having the conversation with you beforehand. And you were very much of the Lennox Lewis sort of kind of camp. And yeah. I'd watched him a few times and, frankly, early in his career, been fairly underwhelmed. And I was among those who at that time thought that Gary Mason had a great shot of winning that fight. And, of course, I mean, as Lennox's career unfolded, it all became clear just how good he was. And when I look back at Lennox Lewis's place in heavyweight history, there's nobody who's a greater admirer, I don't think, of Lennox than myself. But at that time, you know, back at the fight, where did it take place? At Crystal Palace, wasn't it? For that to have gone the other way, I think for the general boxing public would not have been a massive shock.
It's interesting. I mean, the thing is as well, Ian, by the way, you touched upon this at press conferences.
Yeah.
I think they have changed a little bit. They're not as, you don't lose the first hour the same way that you used to, in the sense that some of those Las Vegas ones, like you said, they pull up sponsors, hotel executives, sports and entertainment executives at the hotel, people from the venue, you might get to the promoter by about the half an hour mark. And that's the first thing that you can actually start getting any kind of, you know, words from, because you're not going to write down the sponsors bump and everything else. So yeah, they can be really long and they can be really drawn out. And I suppose, you know, we've not touched upon the post-fight stuff yet, which is sometimes where you get some of the best and most revealing stuff. I remember actually probably the most shocked I've ever been at a press conference was, to his immense credit, although I think with hindsight of having written Damage and knowing what I do about neurological issues of fighters who have been badly concussed, he shouldn't have been there. But Amir Khan faced up to the media after that loss to Bradis Prescott in about his 16th or 18th fight, when he got blitzed in about a minute. And he showed up at the post-fight press conference just as this young kid who had the hopes of a nation. And I think it was his first pay-per-view fight on Sky, wasn't it? And he was draped in the Union Jack and it was really, really pushing him to the moon. And he went and lost in his first fight under the new deal with Sky. I think it was his first box office fight. And to his immense credit, he faced up to the media, because so many people, if it doesn't go their way, run a mile.
54 seconds it was that night. I remember that very clearly, blown away in 54 seconds. So, yeah, all credit. I mean, you just hope that all the right medical protocols have been followed before he's allowed to go out and do that, don't you? I mean, there was a horrible story Glenn McCrory told us. I mean, Glenn, who commentated with us, of course, former World Cruiserweight Champion. And he told me the night he got beaten quickly and beaten up really in short time, made a lot of money, or good money anyway, with Lennox Lewis, he was allowed to drive home afterwards. I mean, imagine that. So crazy, isn't it, really, when you think about it?
Well, hey, from
Albert Hall to the Northeast.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, this is a normal thing, though. I mean, people don't think about this. I remember driving home once after an amateur fight when I got stopped, and I drove over a roundabout thinking it was a perfectly normal thing.
What? You drove over the roundabout?
Yeah, and I sort of went over it thinking it was normal and then thought, oh, I shouldn't have done that.
And that was that because you were woozy?
Yeah, I mean, exactly. I mean, I hadn't drunk or anything like that. So, yeah, and I mean, I would have driven a couple of hours from that fight. So, yeah, I mean, you know, people just don't plan that far ahead.
Do you remember Mike Marley, who used to sort of be a publicist? And yeah, before that, he was a New York Post and been around the sport, entertaining fella. He decided he'd go into a pro celebrity boxing match with Thomas the Hitman Hearns. You know, one lunchtime in Atlantic City, you know, some kind of charity thing. And, oh, okay, he was telling us about it. Okay. And he was crazy enough to try and have a pop at Hearns, you know, and land a punch. And Hearns' just kind of trigger reaction to it was just a snap out of, you know, a half a jab. So I remember seeing Mike Marley in the evening and I said, how did it go? He said, oh, I'm kind of out of it. He said, I said, why, what happened? He said, he just caught me with one half jab. He said, I said, what, you tried to hit him? Are you mad? And so, yeah, I mean, these are all things that happened while we were around fights. I mean, another one I remember is going back to Tyson again. We always seem to keep coming back to Tyson. Do you remember the one where later on in his career, and he'd already lost to Holyfield, and I think it was sort of beyond the time where he'd had the prison. You know, he was on the downslope. And he came in and said that he had objections to the referee because it was the same referee who'd reffed him in the Holyfield loss, which I think was Mitch Halpin at the time. And I remember that one of the journalists, when he'd finished talking, said to him, Mike, there was a time when all you worried about with the referee was whether he could count to 10.
Yeah, and very true.
It was a great moment at the press conference, and it kind of said it at the time too.
Hey, John, I was just going to say
sometimes after fights, when you get the instant reaction now rather than the formulaic press conference thereafter, sometimes you get interesting reactions when nerves are laid bare. I mean, that second loss of Anthony Joshua's against Usyk, I don't think he did himself any favours at all with his interview after that. And there have been other occasions since that when he seems to have become, shall we say, a little thin-skinned.
Do you remember?
Louis
Eubank had a couple of good ones? Sorry, and yes, you were saying about Louis Theroux.
Yeah, Louis Theroux. Did you see that? The Louis Theroux interview with AJ. Fascinating, I thought. He obviously is concerned about now the image of him is someone who's a little bit gun-shy and is thinking about it all a bit too much. And I mean, he's not in that place he was when he was the hottest picket in the country. So I think that's what came over to me anyway. He came over as very likable, I have to say, with lots of charisma, but with that rider.
Yeah, I thought it was good. I wish we saw more of him. I was shouting at the TV once because he said, I don't know why the boxing people don't ever sit down with me and talk about these things and people just write stuff. I'm like, you can't get anywhere near him. You can't get anywhere near him. Like, it's ridiculous him saying that. I mean, I'm sure that he never knows about all the interview requests that never get to him. But I mean, you just can't get near him.
Well, that was the same with Tyson. I can even remember when Roy Gums was the British middleweight champion and sat in front of us when he was about to fight Mark Taylor and said, I don't like you guys. I don't like you guys. You've never given me an even break. You never write about me, you know, and I'm the British champion. And I went up to him afterwards with my radio mic and said, can I just do a couple of minutes with you? And Roy goes, no, I don't talk to you reporters. I said, well, that's why you don't get any publicity.
Hey, by the way, speaking of the post-fight stuff as well, and obviously, John, what you said about AJ was great, and I think it's really important that these guys are properly checked out when they've been in tough fights, 12-rounders, and taken some damage before they're given a microphone, because Tony Bellew was in no fit state to do the interviews after Alexander Usyk. If you look back at that and hear him repeat himself over and over again, that's a clear sign of a brain injury. So we've got to stop forcing these microphones into people's faces. But in terms of what you said and some of the value, I was reminded this week listening to Steve Bunce's brilliant podcast with Chris Eubanks Sr. about a couple of Eubanks post-fight interviews. There was the Marry Me, Karen one, wasn't there? And then there was the one after Michael Watson when he said, test him, please test him for PEDs. Do you remember that?
Yeah.
So you get some of the really core emotions right at the end, and the Marry Me, Karen with Eubank nearly in tears, and the test him, because he couldn't believe what he'd faced with Michael Watson, right?
Yeah. I mean, yeah, I think you get, generally speaking, the post-fight press conference is a completely different kettle of fish, because now you've seen the action, you've seen what happened, and the quotes are illuminating, or should be, about exactly what did happen. I've been quite surprised somehow to hear fighters who basically lost every round contesting the decision and that kind of thing. So I don't know where that comes from. It's interesting the fight that fighters think that they fought in their head. When they look back at the tape later, they might have a different take on it.
Oh, we were talking a bit earlier about people getting under people's skin, weren't we? And whether or not the fight actually gets away from all the bad feeling and all the rest of it. I remember the third fight between Fury and Wilder. Tyson couldn't understand why Deontay Wilder hadn't taken the time to shake his hand and say, well done on the night, you were the better man. You know, but Wilder had obviously been so incensed by some of the advanced publicity and the insults before the second fight and the third fight between the two of them, that he just didn't want to play the game. And in the run-up to the third fight, he almost refused to take the stage with Tyson Fury. There was very little press conference material from the two of them because Deontay was simply fed up of being abused.
Hey, by the way, talking about Fury and Wilder, do you remember, and we gave Fury a bit of stick at the start of this, do you remember the good grace with which he took that draw in Los Angeles in the first fight?
Yeah, he did. He did.
He could have incited a riot that night, but he just played a very docile, friendly, affable, you know, guy who just got wronged. I thought he was all class that night, to be fair.
Yeah, I mean, for what it's worth, I you know what I said at the beginning, quoting what John H. Stracey had said, I actually don't go along with that because I think Tyson is a very bright guy and a lot of what he does is tongue-in-cheek, and he knowingly plays it up to the hilt to try and boost the pay-per-view sales. I think it's a serious commercial operation by him, and I don't actually get as monumentally offended by it as some.
John, let me give you a softball talking about post-fight press conferences. David Hay in Hamburg, talk me through it.
Well, that was an interesting one, wasn't it? Yeah, it was. It was after the. Was it the Chisora Klitschko fight?
No. Sorry, I'm talking about Togate.
Oh, Togates. I thought you were talking about when...
No, we can get to that one. Yeah.
And David hot-footed it to the airport. The police were looking for him, didn't know where he was, and they decided to search the hotel, and they virtually kicked my door down in the hotel. Policewoman walks in with a couple of henchmen alongside him saying, "Is David Hay in here? Is David Hay here?" I thought she was a stripper gram at first. I thought, what's going on here? But that was bizarre. But yeah, Togate, that was not really very good when David, you know, to the bemusement of the media, claimed that he'd blown his big opportunity of the world title fight in Hamburg when he finally got the chance to become world heavyweight champion and have the big fight against Klitschko. And he said that he'd not engaged because he got a bruised toe, which wasn't really terribly edifying. All the more so when we found out afterwards that Vladimir's father was quite literally on his deathbed at the time of the fight. He was dying of cancer as a result of him being involved in the Chernobyl cleanup. And you know, Vladimir Klitschko was going through the fight with that, and David Hay was moaning about a bruised big toe. Not good.
Well, of course, it got worse when he actually stepped up onto the table as well to exhibit said toe.
Yeah. He was a great cruiserweight, David.
Hey, he wasn't a bad heavyweight. Obviously, he starts John Ruiz. He beat Nikolai Valuev on away soil, which is something I don't think Jim Watt actually scored for him, talking to Jim earlier.
The punch he finished Derek Chisora with was one of the great shots I've ever seen.
Yeah, true. And Chisora's never been banged out by that, as far as I can recall. He's never been banged out like that before or since.
We haven't mentioned one of the most famous press conferences or infamous press conferences of all, have we? Naz in Atlantic City. Prince Nassim City.
I wasn't there, but I mean, this lives long in boxing infamy. Actually, on a related note, I bumped into Adam Smith this week at one of the press conferences and had a nice catch up with Adam Smith, who seems to be bouncing back and seems to be doing well. And it was nice to see him. But I know that we're going down the Adam Smith route because he was one of many in Naz's crosshairs, along with Colin Hart and numerous others.
Yeah. Well, John, I think to some extent as well. Yeah, I mean, tell the story briefly. He turned up late in Atlantic City. This was around the time of his breakup with Brendan Ingle. So his mood wasn't great. He tried to order Marco Antonio Barrera. He was fighting McCulloch in this fight. Barrera was on the bill as well. He tried to order Barrera out of the gym so he could go in and train. I mean, that wasn't going to happen, was it? And then he called Colin Hart, you know, the doyen of boxing writers from the Sun, said, "I don't like you. I call you Colin Fart." He moved his chair right up to look him in the face and said that. And Colin, I remember Colin saying, "Well, I don't like you either, but we need to work with each other." And then he said, the bloke from the Mirror asked something, and he said, "Why do you keep asking me questions that you've asked me before?" And so it went on. He was like a stock car. Everything he came into contact with that week, he was crashing and burning. We did the story. I was working for Sky, and we did the story on one of our countdown shows, and a couple of the journalists didn't like it and said, "Well, it's just like..." I said, no. I said, "He's here. It's part of his PR operation in the US. And look what he came in and did. So, of course, we're going to report that." I mean, it was mad. I think there were reasons, things going on in his head, the breakup with Brendan. He didn't feel right. You know, he stunk the place out in the fight as well, even though he won it. So I think we learned plenty at that occasion. And I think, as I've reported before, to be fair to him, he knew he was out of order. And a few weeks later, his dad, I think, ordered him to meet me and Adam Smith in London because he had a right go at Adam, who was very close to him at the time. And he apologized to us. He apologized unreservedly and said, "I was totally out of order. I don't know what I was doing."
Wow.
He was what you alluded to with me, and we're on the boardwalk in Atlantic City, taking a bit of a constitutional, taking a walk, and Naz comes up. I'd written one or two things in the Guardian, who I was writing for at the time, and I think he'd seen them, and he came up to me and, in no uncertain terms, tried to sort of take issue with it, and. One of his brothers said to me afterwards, he said, "Hey, you weren't afraid of him, were you? You weren't afraid." And I said, "No, I mean, I'm who I am. If Naz wanted to hit me, then he could do. And if had he done so, I'd have been able to sue his arse off. I'd never have needed to work again."
You'd have never made 9 stone either, John.
No, I'd not made 9 stone for an awful long time.
Nor me.
And having said that, I don't think Naz sees 9 stone too often now either.
No.
That was an easy line to finish with on Naz there. I mean, it's interesting about Naz. I mean, we look back on, well, so many people look back on those days with real affection, but that was another side of it, wasn't it? I mean, I'm guessing you both had good memories with Naz, though, as well.
Yeah, I mean, he could rub you up the wrong way. He did us all. But I've got to admit, in retrospect, he was a real showman, and he did excite, especially, I think, you know, the audience, the under 30s. People wanted to watch him. He never accepted that some of the people wanted to watch him to see him dumped on the seat of his pants. Well, they never really saw that till later on, did they, with Barrera, etc. But, you know, yeah, he was, as they say, good copy and massive marquee value.
Yeah, and he did it. A lot of it was done through press conferences, wasn't it? It was masterminded by Frank Warren. He did a great job publicising Naz, and I think he was kind of the first British fighter for a long time whose fame had transcended sports. You knew Naz even if you didn't follow boxing.
Yeah, who do you think was the best press conference performer?
Do you know what? I was just going to say this, but I think this is to do with taste. And it's not to do with performance. But I actually went to Chris Billam-Smith's press conference recently for his fight in December against Mateus Mastanak in Bournemouth. And Billam-Smith, who's the WBO World Cruiserweight Champion, is just all class. He's got a self-deprecating humour. He's ambitious. He looks the part. He always dresses smart and... He's respectful to everyone and his opponent, and he says the right things without ever being cliched, and he's interesting, he's engaging. I know it's not the answer you're looking for, but if I was a fighter, I would hold him as the gold standard of how I would want to carry myself at a press conference. How about you, Darkie?
I think I'd say Sugar Ray Leonard, really, because, you know, he was talking with great authority all the time for everything that he did in the ring. You know, pound for pound, he'd be right up there, wouldn't he, in any assessment. So, yeah, I mean, on a funnier side, somebody like Randall Tex Cobb, not that I covered that many of his fights. I've read a million quotes from his press conferences that have made me laugh out loud.
During his fights, he was trying to chat up the ring card girls, wasn't he? His trainer found it very difficult to get him to concentrate on what was actually happening in the fight, because he was trying to sort out his social engagements for later in the evening.
But I good at a press conference, wasn't he? Tony Simpson, you know, who fought Marvin Hagler for the world middleweight title, beat Alan Minter late in Alan's career. He had a great line about Harold Graham, and we all loved Harold, but his style was, you know, at the time, maybe not top box office. And somebody said to him, "Do you want to fight Harold Graham?" And he said, "I'm not going to fight that glorified limbo dancer."
I think the after fight press conference and reaction, I probably admired perhaps as much, if not more than any, was back at the first time that Riddick Bowe fought Evander Holyfield in that extraordinary 10th round, when Holyfield was almost knocked out in the first couple of minutes and then came back and waged absolute war on Riddick Bowe in the last minute of that round. And they went the distance. Bowe gets the decision. Holyfield, who'd been the favourite going into that fight, had suffered what was a pretty big career defeat. And I remember that 20 minutes after the fight, can't have been any longer, up in the press room, up in the press area of the arena, Evander came in and he answered every single question with real class.
He was fantastic, Holyfield. He would just wander around the press room during the week. You couldn't fail to get an interview with him. He was magnificent.
Hey, by the way, talking of some of these special memories, John, you've just reminded me there. So it's very rare that you get any of the major players to sort of willingly come and contribute to some, especially if they don't know you. And I remember Pacquiao was over doing some pre-fight publicity for Hatton. And I was doing a pre-fight press conference with Manny Pacquiao. And he's taking questions and looking at my notepad. And he's answering questions freely. And he's looking quizzically at my notepad as I'm scribbling down. And he stops asking questions and comes over and says, "Shortcut," as in shorthand. And I said, "Yes." And I remember Steve Lillis looking at me thinking, can you believe that he's just taken a bit of time out to just come and, you know, applaud you for having shorthand? You know, it's things like that, you know, where you've got this multi-gazillion dollar star coming over and think and just having a bit of a humane touch. You know what I mean? It was quite nice. You know, obviously that was many moons ago now, 15 plus years ago. And I still remember that, him just making a bit of an effort.
That's a great story, that. I mean, another one I remember, a weird one, was Michael Moore, who was a moody kind of fighter, being at one of his press conferences, and everybody sat there, and he just came in and said, "Any questions?" Well, nobody had any. It was like one of those horrible, awkward silences. So he pulled out a packet of mints and goes, "Anybody want a mint?"
Well, I remember Buster Douglas once told me, going over to the fight in Tokyo, he went to his own press conference and he said there was hardly anyone there. He said no one showed up because everyone was there to do Tyson. Yeah. And he said everyone was just looking around glumly, thinking like, well, I say everyone. He said probably both people were there looking at each other. Don't know. And Buster said the only thing they could really muster was, what color shorts are you going to wear? And that was about it. That's all Buster recalled from the press conference. Gents, this has been great. Before I leave, actually, people who are listening to this podcast, there are both of them. There are people out there who are starting to leave reviews on iTunes, and they are great. And I just wanted to read some out because if you have enjoyed Ringside Rewind, then please go out and give us a rating and review on iTunes. There's one here from Brim MD, who says, a genuinely fantastic podcast presented by three knowledgeable and experienced hosts. Great stories and analysis of boxers and boxing events, primarily from the past. Terrific trio here from Planky 79. Brilliant listening to John, Tris and Ian. And while I'm at it, Tris Dixon's Boxing Life Story is another brilliant podcast. Thank you. And North Steve says, I can't believe I've just found this podcast, but it's meant I've enjoyed binging to catch up on them all. A great podcast reminding me of boxing events I mostly remember. The chemistry between the three works really well, and I recommend for hardcore boxing fans and sports supporters in general. So please go over to iTunes and give us a rate and review. And apologies that we've not heard from John Rawling's dog this week, but that is enough from me, Ian Dark, and John Rawling. You've been listening to Ringside Rewind, and we'll be back soon.
Hi, I'm John Rawling, welcoming you to Ringside Rewind, where I'm joined by Tris Dixon and Ian Dark. And we're grateful for sponsorship from Fleet UK, a car and commercial vehicle leasing company based in Hampshire, supporting our programme. Great people who've supplied customers for 20 years or more, including me. Wherever you are, they'll find and supply any car you want and work out financing options to best suit your needs. Fleet UK pride themselves on transparency, trust and fairness in every deal. And you can take it from me, they are brilliant at what they do. Just have a look and check them out at fleetuk.com.